Hey there, Gratitude Geeks. This is Candace Rodarte coming to you from lovely Lake Michigan. This week, I am sharing a rebroadcast of one of my favorite classic episodes. Enjoy. Welcome to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for solopreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. I'm your host, accountability coach Candace Rodarte, and today I'm joined by Jesuit Brother Guy Consolmagno. Brother Guy is the director of the Vatican Observatory. His research studies the physical properties of meteorites and asteroids. A native of Detroit, Michigan, he received a bachelor and a master's degree from MIT and a PhD in planetary sciences from the University of Arizona. He has served as an officer in the International Astronomical Union, the American Astronomical Society, and the Meteoritical Society. Along with 300 scientific publications, he is the author of a dozen popular books on astronomy and the relationship between faith and science. Are you tired of struggling with follow-up? Do you want to stand out from the crowd but find it difficult to do so in a convenient and easy way? Look no further than Send Out Cards. With Send Out Cards, you can easily stay in touch with those who matter most, celebrate important events, and stay top of mind with just a few clicks on your computer or taps on your phone. In today's world of overflowing inboxes and empty mailboxes, Send Out Cards provides a personal touch that people truly appreciate. Don't get lost in the sea of technology. Go old school with Send Out Cards. Check out the link in the show notes to send your first card free on me or visit momgeek.com/cards. Welcome, Brother Guy.
It's great fun to be here.
I have a story to share with you and the audience because you changed the trajectory of my life when I was 16 years old. And you don't remember this story, so it's going to be fun to watch your face as I tell it. But before we get to that story, please tell us your story. How did you become the director of the Vatican Observatory? What is the trajectory that took you there?
Well, it was not by applying for the job. Absolutely not. It was a very complicated trajectory, in fact. I grew up a wonderful Catholic family, but also college educated. My Italian dad, my Irish mom, both college degrees. Even my grandfather, who came to from Italy as a small kid, got a law degree from Boston University. So education was going to be in the business. And my brothers and sisters both have advanced degrees. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. Sounds familiar. So I went to Boston College thinking I'd be a history major because history was everything. And Boston College was a Jesuit college. I'd gone to the Jesuit high school in Detroit. Well, I discovered that I couldn't stand the kids in the freshman dorms. I mean, a bunch of 18-year-old guys, the fact that I was one of them didn't make it any better. And after, they'd spend all their time, drinking and having too much of a good time, start failing their classes, pour out their souls to me. And I'm going, of course you've got problems, Look what you've been doing every weekend. You're an idiot. Of course you got problems. I decided to join the Jesuits to get out of the freshman dorms.
Okay, well, that's one way to get to that decision, okay?
Yeah, well, it didn't work because the Jesuits want you to actually pray about this kind of stuff. And, pray, who prays? Come on, I'm 18. When I actually sat down, alone in my room and asked God, what am I supposed to pray? What am I getting? I got this little question in the back of my head. You're going to be a priest. What do you think you're going to be doing? Dealing with people with problems. Just like the guys you can't get far enough away from. This would be a terrible job for you to have. So I'm thinking either there's no voice from the ceiling, in which case, no God, why am I being a priest? Or there is a God, and he just told me it'd be stupid for me to be a priest. Instead, I should be a nerd, because that's what I am. My best friend was going to MIT, so I transferred there so I could hang out with him and read science fiction in the science fiction library and basically hang out with fellow nerds. I discovered a really fascinating professor, a guy named John Lewis, who was doing work in meteorites. And that just turned me on like nothing. You could hold pieces of outer space in your hand. I got so excited doing this. I did a master's thesis with him, went on to Arizona, did a PhD. Spent 5 years postdocing first at Harvard and then at MIT doing work on small bodies, moons and satellites and things like that. But there was still that urge that made me want to think about being a Jesuit that had never gone away. And, you know, why am I doing astronomy when people are starving in the world? I couldn't answer the question. So at age 30, figuring I'm getting old, you know, I've got to do something now before it's too late. Plus, 5 years as a postdoc means I couldn't get a job. So I joined the Peace Corps. And the first thing I discovered when I got to Africa was that the Kenyans were as interested in space as I was. They wanted to look through the little telescope. They would go, wow, looking at the moons of Jupiter and the rings of Saturn. And I'm going, maybe they know something I don't. That we don't live by bread alone. We need to wonder about the universe. That really turned me on. So I went back to Lafayette College, taught at a small college for 4 years. That was fantastic. That was so much fun. I thought, okay, here's the path. I'll join the Jesuits again, you know, like the first time I was going to, but this time as a brother. So I won't have to worry about, you know, dealing with crazy people. I can just do my science. They'll have me teach at some university in America. Well, Jesuit brothers, like the priests, have three vows. Poverty, I was used to that. I'd been a grad student. Chastity, I was used to that. I'd been a grad student. And obedience. Not used to that one. Rather than having me teach at a place like Georgetown or, you know, Loyola, they sent me to Rome to be an astronomer at the Vatican Observatory. And I was there for more than 20 years when I got a visit saying, guess what? The Pope's going to name you the director. In both cases, I had no say in it except to say, yes, sir. And you want me to jump? How high?
I don't think I've ever heard a story so incredible.
You couldn't make it up.
You are the director of the Vatican Observatory against your will.
And it's all because I wanted to read science fiction stories, you know, at the world's biggest science fiction library when I was 18.
So the reason why I met you when I was 16 is because you were in the Peace Corps with my aunt, Rita Cummings. And
Of course.
Yes. So I know Rita is listening to this episode because she listens to all my episodes. So why don't you give her a sweet little message? Give a shout out to her.
It's great to see you, Rita. I remember visiting you back when you came back from the Peace Corps and you were living in the Bay Area. And I know our Peace Corps group is going to have our 40th anniversary this summer. So I hope to see you then.
Wow, 40th anniversary. Okay, yeah, That's about right. So here's my story. And here's how you changed the trajectory of my life, because let's get that part over quickly. I was 16 or 17 years old, and you were visiting Aunt Rita in the Bay Area, and I was on my way to Madrid, Spain, to spend the summer at my Aunt Marilyn's house. And not my mother's sister, not my father's sister. My Aunt Rita is my father. Yeah, family is complicated.
Always.
Anyway, I was staying the night with Aunt Rita before I left, and you were also visiting. I believe you're also staying, you know, you're visiting for the weekend, so you're also staying there. And we were in the living room, and I don't remember if it was just you and I or if there were other people in the room, because I'm singularly focused on this particular, you know, 10 second memory that changed the trajectory of my life. So up until that point, everyone called me Candy. And I distinctly remember you you're over 6 feet tall. You were very thin at the time, and you were laying on the ground with your feet crossed and your hands behind your head. And you looked up at me, you lifted up your head and your arms, and you looked at me and you said, Candy's kind of an immature name. And from that moment on, I have been known as Candace. As a matter of fact, when my grandfather came to meet my husband and my baby, he'd never met either of them. My husband and my grandfather are talking to each other, and I hear this really loud voice say, "Who's Candy?" My husband had no idea anybody had ever called me that.
It's astonishing, but it is true that the names you use for yourself can change who you are. My older brother is named, actually my only brother, is named Edwin. And we always called him Wynn because there were so many Eds in the family. But when he went off to college, he became Ed or Eddie. He's the most laid-back musician, blues musician, quiet, but everybody calls him Fast Eddie because that's the exact thing he isn't. And yet, it's part of his personality, and Fast Winnie just wouldn't do it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is true that when I changed my name, which is my name. I mean, my name is Candace. Yeah, it was right. just a nickname. But when I changed my name, everything about me changed. Mm-hmm. It changed my ideas for the future. The trajectory of my life changed from that 10-second off remark that you made while you were laying on the floor in my Aunt Rita's house.
You know, it also sounds like the arrogant me from 1985 or whenever that
87.
Was.
It was 87. Okay. Yeah. 86 or 87. So, and it's kind of fun because I didn't remember that part of the story. I just remembered that it was one of my Aunt Rita's friends when I was 16 or 17 years old who said it. And then I was, after you and I had booked this interview, I was like, it was Brother Guy. It was Brother Guy. And then, you know, it's amazing. It's just amazing. Okay, let's switch focus. I was scrolling through the titles of your books, and I just got to know, would you baptize a extraterrestrial? Would you?
Well, of course, if I give you the answer, nobody will buy the book. But I'll tell you the story behind the question, and then I'll tell you the answer, because everything deserves a story. I was invited to go to the Birmingham Science Festival in Birmingham, England, in 2011, I think this might have been. Whenever it was the year that Pope Benedict was also visiting England. And it was the same day that he was going to be in Birmingham. So a bunch of reporters who couldn't get to the Pope got to the people running the festival and said, oh, can we talk to this Vatican astronomer? I thought they were going to ask me about the astronomy I was going to talk about. They wanted to know, you know, where do you disagree with the most with the Pope? And all sorts of goofy things like, what makes me think I disagree with them? And what makes you think if I did, I'd tell a bunch of reporters, you know, come on. So they weren't getting anything out of me. They didn't want to hear about how the Pope actually really supported the work we do and was a great guy and very much misunderstood in a lot of ways. So finally, out of frustration, one of them comes up with, you know, would you baptize an extraterrestrial? And I go, you know, only if they ask. Because frankly, you know, baptizing somebody is not up to me. It's up to the person getting baptized. I thought that was simple. Later on, somebody pointed out to me that it was a trick question, which I had cleverly sidestepped, cleverly being totally by accident. If I had said yes, then I would say that somehow I was smarter than this creature who'd been able to come across who knows how many light years. If I had said no, then I would be saying that, you know, my religion is only for us yokels here on planet Earth. But to be able to point out if the question ever came up, then that would mean that the ET had something on the ball that those reporters didn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the answer to that question is only if they asked to is, you know, it's like, I'm not going to force anybody to be baptized exactly. unless they want to. I love that.
You know, it wouldn't make any sense. Because it also means that the question only comes up if, number one, there are extraterrestrial intelligences. Probably in the universe, you'd expect there might be, but we haven't found any yet. Number two, that we would be able to be in touch with each other. Number three, that we'd be able to actually communicate. Number four, that we'd have the same interests and, you know, the same fears and the same desires and, you know, the ability to do right and wrong. And all of those presuppositions mean that it's probably not a question that's going to come up anytime soon.
I don't know if there is life on other planets. It was seeded by the same God who seeded the planet, the, you know, the people on this planet. So,
yeah, it's the same chemistry, you know, the same physics. You know, also, we presume the same rules of wrong and right, because that's the basis of every science fiction story. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a story.
Yeah.
So it really does come back to science fiction.
So I'm really curious, why does the Vatican have an observatory or two of them?
You know, well, one observatory with two locations.
Okay.
One is in Castel Gandolfo in the Pope's Summer Gardens, and the other is where I am at the moment in Tucson, Arizona. The interesting reason is that, in fact, astronomy was part of the university curriculum in the medieval universities that, you know, you had to know music, you had to know grammar, you had to know rhetoric, you had to know astronomy, you had to know arithmetic and geometry. These were things that every educated person was expected to know before they could go on to get doctorates in theology or philosophy, which, of course, to this day, you know, my PhD, Doctor of Philosophy, that's still the degree we call it. I'm still, you know, wearing clothes that you could see go back to the Middle Ages. Well, in 1582, Pope Gregory XIII was instructed by the Council of Trent to fix the calendar. The calendar was out of whack in a couple of ways. First of all, the Julius Caesar calendar has one leap year every 4 years, and that's almost enough to make the position of the earth through the sky, or the position of the sun through the sky, depending on which, you know, system you're doing, work out evenly so that you have the same number of days in springtime starting the same day every year. But it's off by about one day a century. And it had been 15 centuries since Caesar had come up with it. It was off by actually about 11 days. So they had to figure out how to fix that. At the same time, people are now traveling around the world. And you've got, you know, Christians everywhere from Japan to California. Time zones are different to say, when is the first day of Easter? When is Easter? The old rule that it was, you know, the first Sunday after the first full moon. What if it's not a Sunday in your part of the world? What if you can't calculate where the full moon is? What, you know, what does it look? The Pope came up, consulted astronomers, and, you know, eventually came up with a reform, which is kind of complicated, but simple enough that it would fit on one sheet. The leap day problem is kind of interesting. Basically, you skip leap year on every century year. So 1700 was not a leap year. 1800 was not a leap year. 1900 was not a leap year. 2000 was, because every fourth century year is a leap year.
I didn't know that about the calendar.
Yeah.
So 2100 will not be a leap year.
Will not be a leap year. And not only did you not know that, whoever came up with the Excel program for Microsoft also didn't know it because they screwed it up.
Is that what the whole 1999 panic was about?
No, that was a different panic. Oh, but, okay. But it was similar. Anyway, the point is that they hired astronomers at that time. Astronomy was being taught at the universities at that time. Astronomy continued. When Galileo came up with his ideas, there were Jesuit astronomers who looked through the telescope and said, yep, you're right. And then they started arguing back and forth. Does this prove this? Or does this prove that? Because you got to remember, Galileo, you know, in the long run was right, but he didn't have the goods for the time. His proofs didn't work. And it took another century before the rest of the astronomical world finally said, okay, now we can see how we can make it work, which is more complicated than what Galileo had.
Can you tell us, most of us learned it in high school, but don't remember, why was Galileo imprisoned?
Galileo was never imprisoned.
He wasn't?
No. That everything you know about Galileo was wrong.
Okay, so I love
most
this.
Most of the Galileo myth was invented at the end of the 19th century in America by people who were trying to keep Catholics out of coming into the country by saying, look what they did to Galileo. We can't have them in America. You know, keep people like my grandfather from coming in.
Of course
the
it
truth
was.
About the truth about Galileo doesn't make the church look any better, because the church did screw up, but the screw up isn't what they were accused of. And basically, Galileo wrote this popular book. He had tremendous support on one side, tremendous enemies on another side. It was very controversial. It's an appealing thought to put the sun at the center, but it didn't match any of the physics of the time. It would be like somebody coming along today and say, oh, I've just, you know, gotten rid of Newtonian physics, which of course Einstein did. And it took a while for Einstein's theory to finally be accepted, because you don't just overthrow established physics without good solid proof. Galileo didn't have it. At the same time, a lot of the philosophy of the day and the theology of the day had assumed Aristotle's physics. If you throw away that physics, then you're going to have to rework all of the philosophy and theology. And turns out they should have, because that theology and philosophy was inadequate. Well, this is a good thing, but you don't do that lightly. Nonetheless, Galileo was writing and publishing for 20 years. He had, you know, one of his books had an imprimatur from the Dominicans saying, we are going to be proud to say that Galileo was one of us. And, you know, a sign of how advanced thought in Rome is. 10 years later, with his friend being the Pope, suddenly Galileo is in trouble. And he's in trouble for a book that he actually had permission to publish. This is the weird thing. The book that, you know, he got in trouble over had already been passed by the Pope's censors. Why did he get in trouble at that moment? You can go to Amazon.com and you'll find 400 books trying to explain the Galileo affair, and no two people agree. The general thought is either it was caught up in the politics of the day, because this was right at the height of the 30 Years' War, and the Spanish were pushing the Pope one way and the French pushing the Pope the other way, and the Spanish actually accused the Pope of being a secret Protestant, you know, which is kind of weird. makes you wonder what bears do in the woods. But the other thing, though, it might have been just that the Pope felt personally insulted by the way that Galileo treated some of his ideas. That's probably the more commonly accepted answer, but there are problems with that one too. As I say, it's not like he didn't know that the stuff was in the book. The truth is, we don't know. But whatever it was not a case of the church being anti-science, because there were Jesuit priests who were astronomers working at the same time. The best map of the moon, the one that, you know, named craters the way we do to this day, was done within 20 years by a Jesuit named Riccioli, who had a telescope that, you know, mapped out the moon in beautiful detail. For the next 100 years, you had people like Volta, who was working on volts. You had, you know, geologists who were Jesuits and other priests. By the 1700s, a quarter of all the astronomical observatories in Europe were run by priests.
Wow.
You had people like Jean-Marie Ampère, devout Catholic, also came up with Ampère's laws for electricity. Mendel in genetics. So this whole idea that the church was anti-science was made up completely out of whole cloth for a political reason. It was, you know, a great example of the big lie. And you think to yourself, well, that was a 19th century. It was a 19th century book. Nobody believes it anymore. But I'll ask you this. When you were a kid, your audience, probably if you were raised in America, you learned at some point about how Christopher Columbus proved the world was round when everybody thought it was flat. Mm-hmm. Utter, complete balderdash.
Who proved it?
Number one, nobody thought the world was flat. Number two, how did Christopher Columbus prove anything? You know, he didn't even make it around the world. Yet we all hear this. It came out of the same book that said that, you know, Catholics are anti-science.
Okay, you brought it up. Why do you think that there is such a strong movement towards the flat Earth society now? Why do you think there are so many people today who believe the Earth is flat?
That's a great question, because you find evidence of this sort of thing in lots of different ways. The people who, in spite of the evidence of, you know, nobody's, after, you know, 20 years of cell phone images, nobody's gotten any better pictures of UFOs than we had before. Why do people still believe in UFOs? After the overwhelming evidence that vaccines save your life, why are people still anti-vaxxers? The answer, I think, comes from a very human temptation. It's been around for a long time. The temptation to be able to say, I'm the smartest guy in the room. I'm smarter than everybody else. My sense of self-worth comes from the fact that I'm smarter than everybody else. And sadly, you find this among, you know, engineers who often will work in companies where somebody else has raised the money, those suits. Who needs the suits? Well, you wouldn't have a company if you didn't have the suits, but never mind that. They're thinking, if your evidence, if your identity is that you're the smartest guy in the room, then how can you ever agree with the majority? And so these are the people who are tempted by all of these crazy ideas that, you know, if everybody else actually adopted that idea, then you'd be on the other side.
Mm. Yeah.
It's called Gnosticism. You can find that in the theologians of the year 300.
Wow.
It actually goes back to, you know, you think about it, the story of Adam and Eve. What's the devil tempting Eve with? Eat this apple and you'll be the smartest person in the world. You know, even though there's only two people in the world at the moment.
Yeah.
You'll be smarter than God. That's the temptation. Wow. That's why people try to, you know, find the truth on the internet rather than just opening their eyes and walk around and see what's actually going on in the world in front of them.
And why they're so, they so easily believe things that are patently false.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's sad. It's really sad. All right. So I'm a fan of this current Pope.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you've met him. Is he as groovy as he seems on TV?
I've met all three of the popes, and I've really
well, there have been more than three popes.
The three that I've worked with, I should put it that way. I've met all three of the popes I've worked for. But Francis, what you see is what you get.
He just seems like such a kind man.
The only thing that you see behind the scenes when he comes off stage, as it were, is you can say, okay, he's tired. It took a lot out of him. Being in front of that many people, having that weight on him. Frankly, it's astonishing that he's not crushed by it. Anyway, I would be. I could.
How much do the robes weigh?
No, it's not that kind of weight.
It's the weight of the world.
Yeah. And yet he and John Paul II both got energy out of being in front of people. Being in front of people who, you know, wanted to hear what he had to say.
That energy of the positive feel. I mean, when he's speaking to people, they are sending him love. And that love, he's feeling that love.
Absolutely. And it makes a difference. And you can see that's where he gets the energy from. But he's a fascinating character. He's very, very smart. Very good politician. You don't survive in Argentina, where you know, politics is cutthroat.
Well, you can see, you can observe that he is politically he's savvy based on the things that he does. He makes smart decisions, and he's moving the Catholic religion forward, which is nice. It's nice to see that happen.
But he's also doing it without, you know, trying to split it apart.
Yeah.
Recognizing that the people with different opinions deserve to have their opinions listened to. And once you listen, maybe you're going to change what you do or how you do it or how you go about it. Because, you know, you got 1.6 billion people who, you know, call themselves Catholics one way or another. And you're going to have 2.6 billion opinions. It's important that everybody is listened to and knows that they're listened to. And there is an example for the rest of us.
Yeah.
One of the joys of astronomy, to me, especially in this world where, you know, everybody's got a reason to hate you, is astronomy is the one thing that can unite everyone. Looking at the stars and going, oh, wow, we all live under the same sky.
Yeah.
And I find that I have friends who are, you know, politically as opposite as you can imagine, and yet they're friends of mine and therefore friends of each other. And we can talk astronomy and enjoy that. And remember the things that are more important than, you know, who won the last election.
How do you feel about going to Mars?
In the long run, absolutely. In the short run, please don't.
Really?
And the reason for the short run is I want to know, to go back to our earlier conversation, I want to know if life evolved independently on Mars. But I'm afraid if we send people there too quickly, we'll find life and it looks like terrestrial life, and then we'll never know. You know, was it something we brought or was it something that came out of its own? And that's, you know, how life evolves naturally everywhere. Or even, you know, maybe the life originated on Mars and came to us. We've got Martian meteorites. The meteorites have cracks that are just the right size that microbes could hide in them.
Yeah, that we needed to clarify what life meant.
Yeah. But, you know, even if we're talking about the obvious bacteria that look like the bacteria we're used to, I want to make sure that whatever we find on Mars is not the result of contamination.
So how do you do that? We're not ready.
A lot of time studying it, bringing the samples back by robots. Send your robots there, cover the place with robots, but don't let people there until you know what you're doing, and maybe even until you know how to confine people better than we can do yet.
So is that a possibility? Can the robots bring,
it's a matter of money. You know, it's
yeah. And it's a matter of allocating the dollars to the
money and will. Yeah. We've got designs on the books now for bringing samples back. We've got the meteorites, but we don't know exactly where the meteorites come from. We don't have the geological situation that they are arriving from. So you'd like to be able to have the robot say, okay, I'm going to take some of these, what they used to call berries, that look like the sorts of minerals that harbor life on Earth. Let's take some of those, bring them back and see, is there anything that looked like it might have been Martian life? Anything that looks like it might be Martian life now? We don't know.
How interesting. But you believe that water was on Mars?
Oh, everybody knows water's on Mars. It's one of the running jokes that NASA announces the discovery of water on Mars every 6 months, and they've been doing this for 30 years.
So is there still water on Mars, or just evidence that there was?
Oh, there's certainly lots of water on Mars now. It's frozen.
Okay, that makes sense. All right.
But
I'm a layman when it comes to space. I love space. I'm a layman.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But if you go not too deep down below the surface, it could be warm enough where the water is liquid. And we have seen cliffs where it looks like some sort of fluid carried material out of a layer and then downhill into the basin. So it could well be that there's liquid water under the surface of Mars right now.
Interesting. And there's liquid water under the surface of the Earth everywhere.
Sure.
So that is a perfectly logical assumption.
And there could be, some sort of bacteria living in that kind of situation.
Okay.
We won't know until we've got the piece and we've been able to look.
So you don't think we're ready for Mars, but what about the moon? I mean, we're going back to the moon.
Oh, I'd love to go to the moon. I think the moon would be a great place to go.
Do you want to go?
I'm scared of heights.
So I was going to ask you that. My next question is, do you want to take one of those space flights that you don't want to do, one of those civilian space flights?
Right. Whenever I read the science fiction books about, the first people in space, which is what they were talking about when I was a kid and we hadn't gotten into space yet, I never wanted to be the astronaut. I wanted to be the guy who built the rocket or the one who told them what to look for.
I
don't want to be Frodo. I want to be Gandalf.
I love that. Y'all are the most important people. My daughter is a paleontologist. I guess I can call her paleontologist. She's a grad student now, but she has a paleontology undergraduate degree. Right. And she likes doing the data entry and the cataloging and the looking under the microscope. She doesn't want to go in the field and dig.
Yeah, you need all types, right? That's why science is always done by teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you feel about dinosaurs?
What about them?
What is your thought on the longevity of dinosaurs?
It's a lot of folks astonishing, really.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Yeah.
It's astonishing, really, to recognize how long dinosaurs were on the surface of the Earth. And, all the different dinosaurs that kids play with, a lot of them did not, live in the same epoch. Some of them were, half a million years before the others. And yet, as they say, there are no dinosaurs today, thanks to the fact that they didn't have a space program.
That's so cute.
Unless you go along with the theory that birds are really, what dinosaurs evolved into, maybe.
Which there's a lot of evidence for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's working on a project with microscopic, not microscopic, but she spends a lot of time looking under a microscope at trays of pebbles and picking out the bones from the rocks. And she says it's a little boring, but I don't think that she would. I think that
you wouldn't do it. Yes. It can be tedious. But at the same time, it's tedious, like working on a jigsaw puzzle is tedious.
Yeah.
It's tedious and addicting at the same time.
So why do some folks, why do you think that there are some folks who, I mean, obviously you understand that the Earth is more than 6,000 years old. So how do we teach people, I don't think teach is the right word, but explain that 6,000 isn't literal?
Mm-hmm. Some of it comes from that desire to be smarter than the other guy, or in this case, holier than the other guy.
Which you mentioned earlier, yes.
That comes from that. Some of it, too, comes from a peculiarly American culture that I want to be able to find things out on my own. And, okay, here's the book. There's the stuff in the book. I don't want to learn it from somebody else. I don't trust anybody else. I want to figure it out on my own. And... at the same time, you can praise it and shake your head at it, because really, what's the point of knowing that it's one way or the other if you don't tell anybody? And if you're going to be telling somebody else what you've discovered, you also, as a fair human being, ought to be listening to what they have to tell you. Science is this conversation. I can remember as a kid when, you know, during the summertime, when the folks would be sitting around a campfire and, you know, drinking beer and talking about politics or whatever. Us kids are in the background in the shadows, hoping they don't send us to bed yet. And listening in on the conversation, waiting for the day when we could be old enough that we could actually contribute something, that we could be part of it. That's what graduate school is.
Yeah.
Learning how to become part of the conversation that goes back, you know, to the medieval universities, to, you know, to the Vatican Observatory that was established in the 1890s as the descendant of those earlier people, to try to, you know, show the world that the church supports science, to get back to the first question that we never got around to answering.
What? Okay, go ahead.
Well, basically, I was just saying it is recognizing that we are a people, not a person, that science is not Doc Brown inventing, you know, a time machine. It is a community of people learning from each other, being corrected by each other, challenging each other. And that's why I think it's important to be part of a church rather than just trying to find Jesus on your own. Because if you don't have that correction, you wind up believing some really crazy things and not even recognizing that they're crazy. Or not seeing that, you know, this really seems like it's going on, but it sounds crazy. And then you find out that, no, there's a whole community of people who have come to the same conclusion. It's not as crazy as you think.
Well, there seem to be a lot of churches here in North America that are not the kind of safe places that you're describing.
The sad thing is that those are the ones you hear about. The most churches are not like that.
Yeah.
Even most evangelicals are not like that. There is a whole, our organization, the American Scientific Affiliation of essentially evangelicals who are not, you know, literalists. Because the other side of it, and the fault is on the side of the scientists. Too often, just as truly religious people aren't the ones you see on TV, real scientists aren't the ones you see on TV.
Yeah.
And I won't name names, but there are some people out there selling science with a list of absolute facts that you must believe if you're a scientist. And you're going, no, that's not how science works.
No.
That's not what science is.
That's anybody who's taken science in ninth grade knows that that's not how science works.
And even in ninth grade, they still teach you to get the answers in the back of the book. But science isn't the answers in the back of the book.
Well, you're taught to reason and to experiment, yeah, and to figure out, and, you know, failing is good. That's the thing I love about science, is failure is fantastic. SpaceX recently shot off a rocket and it exploded, and they called it a success, and everybody else said, no, it's not. But really, it's any, they got it off the ground, right?
And not only that, they also discovered, oh, there is a reason why everybody else builds launch pads with these other things that we didn't think we needed. Maybe we should have been part of that community and listened to them.
So did they learn from that experience, and are they going to involve people who already understand launch pads? Yeah, that's the thing about SpaceX. They are a little arrogant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
but you know, I go back to, I was mentioning Adam and Eve. The books of scripture are not books of science. They're books about God. They're books of theology. And in scripture, you'll find four or five different places where the beginning of the universe is described, and it's not described the same way, because these books were written over a period of 400, 500 years. No surprise that they're going to be, you know, different stories. What is consistent in all of them? The thing you can draw out of scripture, which makes science possible, is number one, the belief that the universe is real as God. And this is different from some religions that want to say, tell you that, you know, everything is illusion. The second point is that the universe is logical and reasonable and follows a pattern as regular as day follows night, and that it's good. You know, there are people who would say that chocolate is evil because it makes you fat and it gives you acne. But I say chocolate is a foretaste of the goodness of God, as long as you don't abuse it.
Which is true for anything.
Exactly. And so, you know, which religion do you want to believe? To me, definitely the one that says, accept that the universe is good. Mm-hmm. And what's the whole point of the Genesis story of the 7 days? Where is it all leading up to? You know, it parallels in a lot of ways the old Babylonian creation myth, but the end point of the Babylon myth was the city of Babylon. The end point of the Genesis story is the seventh day, the Sabbath, the day where we get to be more than just well-fed cows and can look back and wonder about the universe and notice how beautiful it is, just as, you know, the people who I encountered in Africa taught me. That this is why we're human, to ask these questions. This is why we do astronomy when people are starving in the world. This is why we're not satisfied with whatever it is we've got now, no matter how wonderful it is. But we want to try new things, and we want to go new places, whether it's to the moon or who knows where.
Wow. I could listen to
you. And that's true regardless of what the scientific cosmology is.
Yes. And the thing about science is it's fluid. I mean, there are some things, the rotation of the Earth, but from what mm-hmm. I understand, sometimes the poles change. I mean, I'm not a scientist, so.
And the rotation can speed up or slow down by a few seconds. It's enough to, so it's there, but it's not perfect. Our understanding is there, but it's never perfect. And that's the fun of it. Wow. If it was perfect, it would be the most boring thing in the world to do.
Let's talk about your work. So you're a meteorologist,
meteoriticist.
Meteoriticist, that's a whole.
Yeah, no,
which is not tough. A meteorologist, meteoriticist.
So, they both have to do with the sky, that's all.
So what, do you actually do work with meteors? So what's
meteorites,
yeah. Meteorites. So what is the coolest mm-hmm. thing you've ever found or discovered?
Ah, well, there are people, I mean, I'm one of a dozen astronomers at the Vatican Observatory. There actually is a fellow who does work with meteors, which are the little flashes of light. And we've got cameras set up both in Rome and here in Tucson. We set up a telescope in Tucson because the light pollution meant we couldn't observe from Rome anymore. And he works out from the duration of the flash and the position of the flash and the brightness of the flash. He can work out what these materials are made from and even where eventually, which ones come from comets, which one comes from asteroids. It's just a brilliant piece of work that he's been able to do, Jean-Baptiste Kikwaya. He comes from the Congo. He did his mathematical studies in Belgium, and then from his understanding of the mathematics of orbits, he applied that to meteors. So we do study meteors. The thing that I do with meteorites, I started out actually being interested in moons and asteroids and how they're put together. Well, a big factor is how much of them are ice, how much of them are rock. Well, what's the rock going to be? You can tell if you know the density of a moon and you know the density of the ice and the density of the rock, you can work out what proportions you need. No one had ever actually systematically measured the densities of meteorites. These are the rocks from space. And yet no one had sat down because there's no money in it. There's no NASA grant to do this. It takes 15 years. But when I got to the Vatican Observatory, the first thing was the director said to me, Guy, here's your job. Do good science. So I had the freedom to spend 10 or 15 years to do this work. And the second thing I discovered is that there were 1,000 meteorites sort of haphazardly packed around in drawers that no one was using. So I named myself the curator and gave myself permission to figure out how to measure these densities in a way that would not harm the meteorite. We came up with a couple of clever ways of measuring it. We discovered that meteorites, in general, are much denser than Earth rocks because they have little flecks of iron in them.
Interesting.
10 to 15% iron.
Do you think that the iron is what attracts them to the planet?
No. No? No, well, okay. It's simply mass. It simply orbits like anything else. Okay. Not a bad thought, but no. But here's the thing.
I'm not a scientist. I'm just curious. I'm science curious.
Absolutely. That's the best. At the same time that we were measuring that the meteorites have a density of about three and a half times the density of water, NASA was sending spacecraft going through the asteroid belt. And by seeing how the spacecraft were deflected by the mass of an asteroid, they cleverly sent it near that asteroid just for this experiment. They found out that the asteroid, which to all the colors and everything else looks like made out of the same stuff as the meteorite, but the asteroid was 20 to 30% less dense, less massive than the meteorites. Huh. You're going, all right, how do you do that? The asteroids are not big lumps of rock. They're piles of rubble. They've had a history where they were broken apart and fell back together, but there's lots of gaps. I mean, if you had a bucket of sand at the beach and you had an identical bucket full of water, you could pour about half a bucket's worth of water into the bucket of sand before the water came out the top. Mm-hmm. There's all that space.
Yeah.
Sand is 50% porous. These asteroids range from 20 to 50% porous.
Interesting.
Well, suddenly, you've got a whole vision of where did the asteroids come from? These are not a planet that broke apart because they haven't been chemically differentiated the way a planet would do it. These are bits that never fell together into a big planet. And yet they ran into each other. They must have run into each other, blew each other up. The stuff would fall back together. This has got to be what happened over and over again. When did that happen? Must have been in the early solar system. So you see, you can start to work out a whole chain of what must have happened to get us to the state we're in today from a very simple measurement of the density of the meteorite compared to the density of the asteroid.
Wow.
That's the fun.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. Well, it's always also curious to me because you had 15 years to just play in this sandbox of meteorites, and in academia and in, you know, corporate America or corporate world, that you wouldn't have been allowed to do that because there wouldn't have been any funding for it.
That's
so,
right.
So, how do we take advantage of the fact that the Vatican lets scientists play in the playground to get more? What kind of research? What other kind of research can the Vatican do?
We do tend to do surveys. I mean, as I say, there's a dozen astronomers here. A number of them have done surveys. For instance, you may have seen that marvelous picture that Hubble made a few years ago. Webb has done a similar one of very, very distant galaxies, galaxies from the beginning of the origin of the universe, 13 billion years ago. What you can see in these images are the shapes of the galaxies. That's really the data that you have to work with. Do those shapes look any different from similar galaxies that are much younger? Well, there was a guy in our group who realized nobody had ever actually done a systematic imaging of galaxies at the same resolution from nearby. So he set himself up to do that and was able to show that, okay, these shapes are similar, these shapes are different, this is how galaxies evolved. That was, of course, you know, several years worth of work.
Oh. And what did he find? What's the most significant finding from that study, that survey?
That's embarrassing because I don't know the work well enough to be able to say this is the cool thing.
Just
the fact that he did it. Just
that's
the fact
the coolest
that he did
thing.
It
yeah.
is the coolest thing to me.
Yeah.
We've got a fellow who's looked at star clusters in our own galaxy that are embedded in dust. And through a series of techniques, he's worked out how you can study them in spite of the dust around them that changes the color of the light coming from there. We have a fellow who's been doing surveys of galaxies that have passed close to each other, and in the gravity of the one is dragging out stars from another so that in the images, they look like jellyfish.
Wow.
And they're called jellyfish galaxies. And again, you look at one and you go, wow, you look at lots of them. And then you can begin to say, all right, here are some interesting characteristics we might not have noticed.
So jellyfish galaxies, that means that, let me see if I can wrap my head around this. Two galaxies pass close enough to each other that one pulls things
yep.
from the other.
Yep.
Wow. And so it's not just one, there's many of them.
It happens a lot.
Oh. And how many galaxies have actually been cataloged?
Cataloged is a tough answer. We have looked at certain regions with enough detail that you can say if this is typical of the entire universe, within the range of our telescopes are probably 200 billion galaxies.
That number is, and you've only been out, that's only what can be seen.
Yep. And
When
each galaxy might have something like 100 billion stars.
I live on Lake Michigan, and when I stand on the shoreline and look at Wisconsin, there is no way I can see Wisconsin. No way. And so, but I know it's there.
Yes,
So
yes.
beyond those 200 billion galaxies are infinite more galaxies.
We don't know. That's the only thing we can assume. I was worse because I grew up in the thumb part of Michigan, and the freighters were always, basically they hug the American coast because it's the shortest route. But to us, it always seemed like the freighters were right in the horizon, and Canada must be just as far in the other direction. Then one time, my dad and I sailed from Port Sanilac all the way across to Canada and discovered, yeah, you get past the freighters, and boy, it's a long way before you get to the other side. The universe is like that. We just don't know how much there is beyond what we know. And bigger than all of that is the God who made it.
It's when you fly over Lake Michigan or when you fly over the Pacific Ocean or the Atlantic Ocean, it just keeps going on and on and on and on.
And yet, that's just this tiny speck of a planet around a run-of-the-mill, G-type star in one galaxy among 200 billion that we know of. And yet, it's a special place because you happen to exist in that place. And there will never be a universe that doesn't have you in it.
I just got a little choked up. Okay, we need to start wrapping up. I would love for you to share with the audience the best place to follow you if they want more wisdom from you.
We actually have started working out on this outreach, and ultimately it comes down to a website, www, and we still use that, Vatican Observatory, all spelled out, .org. And if you go there, you'll see, of course, recent things that we posted. We post new things on the website all the time, and most of that is found in a place called Sacred Space Astronomy. But on the other hand, if you're an educator or you just want to know more about faith and science, we've got a collection called the Faith Science Resource Center of about 500 articles, YouTube videos, reviews of books, of stuff that we think do a good job. Things we think do, I got to get the grammar right. Things we think do a good job of exploring how faith and science interact. Not that this is the answer and you've got to believe this, but rather, no, these are fruitful ways to think about the problems, the issues, the joys. And if you're teaching the stuff, you can use these as resources. And if you just want to find out for yourself, go crazy.
So interesting. Okay, so you are the director of the Vatican Observatory, so you probably aren't in charge of this, but you do have your thumb on what's going on with the people that you work with. So how is the Vatican Observatory marketing? What are they doing for outreach?
It's tricky. We have a foundation in the United States which raises money to support the work of the Vatican Observatory. It also raises money to support the telescope, the maintenance every year, and other programs, scientific programs that we do. The Vatican basically pays for two-thirds of all of our expenses, and this foundation comes up with the other third. Within that, we've got the newsletters for people who sign up. We've got the website for people who want to do that. But we also organize schools, whether it's a school for graduate students once every 2 years in Castel Gandolfo, where they spend a month with some of the best astronomers in the world, including, in a couple of cases, Nobel Prize winners, to go into some tiny corner of advanced astronomy. We've got a workshop that we run every couple of years here in Tucson for ministers. We call it Astronomy for Ministers Astronomy for Catholic Ministers in Education, which spells out ACME. Obviously, we came up with the ACME first because we're in the land of roadrunners and coyotes.
Of course.
And that's, again, for, you know, educators, for people who want to spend a week with us.
Do you, is it only for Catholics, or is it, or do you allow Protestants into your fold?
We prefer Catholics, but if you're a Protestant who, you know, gets what we're about, we usually get about 40 to 50 people applying for 25, and we've had non-Catholics as part of it. And certainly we have non-Catholics teaching you know, as part of the, there was one of the astronomers who's talked about cosmology for us for many years, had taught at Jesuit schools and had spent time in Ireland. And I assumed she was Catholic until I was invited to her son's bar mitzvah. I go, oh, okay. Didn't know that.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
That is so funny.
But in between, we give a lot of talks too. And you can, you know, the newsletter sort of gives you a schedule of where the talks are going to be. So if people want to know more about us, you go to the website, you sign up for the newsletter.
Oh, speaking of a newsletter, which I don't know how this these two even come together, but I am on a text message thing from NASA, and every time the space station goes over my house, it tells me you're going to be able to see the space station tonight. And I know things are wrapping up, and I know this is not your field at all, but will you please share your thoughts on the space station, on the International Space Station?
There are a lot of fellow astronomers who would complain all the money being spent for people in space, you know, heck, you build 10,000 robots for the cost of... they got a point, but there was a book about the early space race in the 1960s called The Right Stuff. Tom Wolfe wrote this, and they made a fabulous movie about it. And one of the lines is, you know, that funding is what, you know, allows you to go into space. And they say, ah, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. But I think it's the other way around. If you don't have the Buck Rogers, you don't get the bucks.
Yeah.
Every robot on the surface of the moon is a promissory note for someday people are going to be there. And we're just trying to figure out what's the best place to put people. Even Mars, where, as I say, I prefer people wait a while before going. In the long run, this is the universe we live in. And it's the adventure. It was just as the adventure stories of science fiction that got me to go to MIT and eventually learn the science. It is that human adventure which we see in the space station that will continue to draw us to want to be in space. And it's also a sign how we can cooperate with each other across national lines to accomplish things that we all want to do because we do all live under the same sky.
I cannot remember the name of the movie, and it's not a good movie, but their opening scene is one of the best opening scenes of any science fiction movie I've ever seen. And it is a space station orbiting the Earth. It's not the International Space Station. It's a futuristic version of it. And it's just this repeating scene of people, of spaceships docking with the space station and people coming off of the space station from different countries. And the next thing you know, every, you know, dozens of countries are represented on this space station. And then the first alien docks, and then the second alien docks, and the third alien docks. And then this International Space Station becomes a something out of the greatest science fiction ever. But it's one of the most beautiful science fiction opening scenes of any movie I've ever seen. It just takes my breath away every time I see it. And the name of the movie will be in the show notes, listeners.
Well, I remember, too, the marvelous bit about that scene in Star Wars, you know, the first real one that came out in 77. We're in the cantina, and all of the different aliens are accepted, but we don't want those droids, heaven forbid. Showing, you know, human prejudices and goofiness will continue on because it's part of who we are.
I have had so much fun chatting with you and catching up after after almost 40 years and being able to share a really pivotal moment in my life when I made a decision that changed everything. Right. So thank you. Thank you for that part that you played in my life that you didn't even know. You know, it's those moments that people don't realize that those little 10-second moments, you would never have known if we hadn't have had this conversation here.
Exactly. So, which means who knows what horrible things we've done in 10 seconds and ruined people's lives, but we won't go there.
Or enhance people's lives.
Or enhance.
But, no, yes. I understand what you're doing with that.
Yeah.
So this is your moment of gratitude. For whom or what are you most grateful?
I'm grateful primarily to my parents, who gave me the opportunity and the encouragement to do what I get to do today. And to that Professor John Lewis, who showed me how to be a professor, how to be an astronomer, and to never lose sight of the fun, and to never lose sight of the desire for truth rather than just showing up the other guy. Those are the people that I'm really, really grateful for forever.
Thanks for tuning in to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for solopreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. Make sure to visit gratitudegeek.com for the show notes, where you can find links to all the groovy resources mentioned and ways to connect with our guest, Jesuit Brother Guy Consolmano. If you love this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on Audible, iTunes, Good Pods, or your preferred podcast player so you never miss an episode. Our theme music is Track 14 by Rev Brock and Sololi. I'm your host, Candice Ridardi, reminding you that gratitude is like manure. It's just a pile of poo until you spread it around. Stay groovy, my friends.
Stay groovy, my friends.
I know we can make it.